The Book Nook on WYSO was presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. And today I have a program that is going to pique a lot of interest. It's the first day of spring as we're recording this. Baseball season's just around the corner. And we have a baseball book for you written by Keith O'Brien. It's called Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. Keith joins us on the telephone. Now, where are you, New Hampshire?
I'm in New Hampshire, yes, Vic. Thanks for having me.
You're a Cincinnati guy. Tell us about your background.
Yeah, Cincinnati, born and raised. I was born on the west side, grew up primarily on the east side of Cincinnati. Most of my family still lives in town there. And, you know, I was born in Cincinnati in the 1970s, too young to remember the big red machine years and sort of the pinnacle of Pete Rose's career at that time. But I'm in the wheelhouse, you know, of my love for baseball when he returns to Cincinnati in 1984. And I remember very well everything that happens next, you know, the good and the bad. And, you know, I think one thing that a lot of people have forgotten is just how iconic Pete Rose was in those days. And so, he was really woven into the fabric of our lives in the way that some of our, you know, great athletic icons are. And so I, with this book, I wanted to go back and revisit that time and this story, because I do think it is an epic story, Pete Rose's story. And it is, as the subtitle of the book suggests, a story of a rise and a fall. And, you know, I wanted to capture all of that. And, you know, as I got into it more and more, Vic, I began to realize that this really isn't even a baseball story. It's really a Greek tragedy that just happened to play out in and around the baseball field.
Well, it looks like you got a lot of interviews with Pete Rose, and then suddenly he stopped cooperating. Did he figure out maybe this wasn't going to be a puff piece you were writing?
I don't know. You know, I early in my reporting, I started to reach out to everybody, and including Pete Rose, and Pete was willing to speak with me, and he did grant me unprecedented access, to be honest. Pete has never spoken to an author for a book for which he did not have editorial control. Mm. And I was not offering that here. I was just offering him a chance to reckon with the past. And, you know, we did lengthy phone interviews, and then I spent 3 days with him in Las Vegas, where he lives these days. And a couple of days on the road with him at autograph shows in Cincinnati. And it was after that he just stopped calling me back. And I don't know, to be honest, why, and I don't want to speculate. But I did try to push him. You know, I wanted to understand why. Again, in the last 35 years that Pete has been banished from baseball, he has at times sort of become a caricature of his former self. And because of that, you know, we've sort of forgotten the story here. And the truth of the matter is, you know, this was an extraordinary rise. There was no reason why Pete Rose ever should have been a major league ball player, much less the all-time hit leader. It frankly never should have happened. And yet it does. You know, he, this man of an ordinary background, white working class west side of Cincinnati, and of really, frankly, ordinary talent, becomes this great hitter. And then really in large part by his own choices and his own decisions and decisions he makes again and again and again, he self-implodes and he loses all of that. And so the real, you know, crux of many of my questions, especially as we spent more and more time together, was why? And I think those are hard questions for Pete Rose to answer.
My guest is Keith O'Brien. His new book is Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. You're listening to the Book Nook on 91.3 WYSO, fact-based journalism in service of democracy. I am not from this area, so I had other teams I rooted for growing up, and one of them was definitely not the Reds. I didn't like Pete Rose. I saw him run over Ray Fosse in 1970 at the All-Star Game, and that really solidified my dislike of him, but I admired his abilities and his drive and his skill at baseball. He had a relentless drive and motivation to be what he was. And reading your book, it really is like a Greek tragedy, because this poor guy, he couldn't admit the truth. He could have saved himself. He could be in the Hall of Fame. He obviously has a gambling problem, which I assume he probably still has if he lives in Las Vegas. He was a pathological liar. He was unfaithful to his wife. He was horrible. He's not very likable at all, especially in the latter parts of the book. I mean, you had access to some of his gophers, and man, this is really nasty stuff. This guy he ripped off for $40,000 to pay off one of Pete's bookie debts. I mean, this is crazy.
Yeah, you know, he is a complicated, complex character. You know, he was lauded for being a baseball hero, but he often, you know, was the villain in his own narrative off the field. And, you know, and what one thing that I sort of hit upon, Vic, is a dichotomous sort of quality about Pete. You know, the same thing that made him successful on the field, the same characteristics that made him successful on the field were, in the end, the same qualities and characteristics that almost ensured his failure as a man. You know, you mentioned Ray Fosse. I did a ton of reporting around that story, the 1970 All-Star Game, you know, that moment where Pete Rose barrels into Ray Fosse at Riverfront Stadium to win the game for the National League. I did a ton of reporting around it because that is the moment when Pete Rose became Charlie Hustle. Again, to put it in perspective, in 1970, July of 1970, most baseball fans and most Americans had never seen Pete Rose play. You know, this was an era where nationally televised games was very rare. The Reds weren't often in them. They didn't play in the playoffs for the entirety of Pete's career with the Reds in the 1960s. So in July 1970, when he, you know, barrels into Ray Fosse to win the game in a meaningless exhibition game, this is the moment when America sees him. And so there's a photograph in the book of Ray in the dirt, clearly in pain, and Pete sort of celebrating and smiling, standing above him. And in that snapshot is sort of everything. Pete Rose becomes Pete Rose and Charlie Hustle right then. And it's because he refused to lose. He refused to fail. He refused to be weak. Of course, he was going to slam into Ray Fosse to win the game. But that same mindset, you know, refuse to lose, refuse to be weak, refuse to be vulnerable, is what prevented Pete, you know, from being honest about what I believe my reporting shows was an addiction to gambling in the 1980s. And if he had been honest in 1989, when baseball first confronted him about what they were hearing, I believe the whole story is different.
Yeah, you can really see that. The book is Charlie Hustle, a nickname he got from Mickey Mantle, and it was derisive.
It was. Another moment and scene that I did a lot of reporting around. Yeah, in 1963, Pete had spent 3 years in the minor leagues, and he was at spring training in Tampa and suddenly found himself with a chance to make the big league roster. It was March. He had impressed the manager of the Reds at the time, a man named Fred Hutchinson. And there was a game, actually on March 17th, 1963, at Al Lopez Field in Tampa, the Reds' home park there, where the Yankees came to town. And this was sort of the legendary Yankees, you know, Maris and Mantle and Berra and Ford. This is that team. The stadium is sold out. Pete Rose's father, Big Pete Rose, is sitting behind home plate. And this game actually is carried on television back in Ohio, which is pretty rare for a spring training game in 1963. And it was being carried because of the Yankees. You know, the Reds didn't play the Yankees in those years. Here was a moment where they were, the game's on TV. And Pete plays that game like it's the seventh game of the World Series. Mm. And it wasn't just that game. He did it that entire spring. You know, he's, you know, sprinting down to first base. He's trying to break up double plays, slamming into second. He's sliding into home plate. And then in the fifth inning of that game, again, a meaningless exhibition game, Pete lays down a bunt for a hit. And, you know, Mickey Mantle and Whitey Ford thought it was, frankly, absurd. You know, that this kid was playing this hard in a spring training game. Mm-hmm. And, you know, on the steps of the dugout that day, the visitor's dugout, you know, they were essentially laughing at him. And they came up with some kind of name for him. And in the days to follow, you know, the newspaper accounts were sort of at odds with each other about what the exact name was. You know, some said that they had called him Henry Hustle. Some said that they had called him the Charlie Hustler. And then it just sort of settled on he was Charlie Hustle. And again, it was intended to be an insult, really. Mm-hmm. But in a masterstroke of branding, which Pete wouldn't have been a word that Pete would have used in 1963 or even now, but this is what it was. You know, for the entirety of that summer, when he does make the big league club and he's going from town to town and he's meeting baseball writers for the first time, he tells everybody that, you know, Mickey Mantle and Whitey Ford called him Charlie Hustle. They liked the way he plays. And so he sort of pivoted and turned what was intended to be an insult into his entire persona.
He embraced it. The book is Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. Keith O'Brien wrote it. He joins us on the program today. If you're a baseball fan, this is just really a divine book to read. But as you stated, it's got a much wider appeal because we see how this deeply flawed individual really blew it. Can we talk about the gambling a little bit? Because it sounds like you had access to some of his gophers. And these guys, they had all the info. And when this guy got into Pete's bad side by loaning him $40,000, you think Pete would have loved that. But apparently, Pete wasn't willing to pay that debt. And that ended up being the one thing that really cost him.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, at the time in the 1980s when the scandal breaks, you know, a lot of the papers, you know, refer to these guys as gophers. But, you know, I've met, you know, these men. They were young men who were just frankly enamored, you know, by Pete in a way that everybody would have been in the 1980s. And, you know, in my research and my reporting, I was able to interview three different men who were in Pete's inner circle in the 1970s and 80s, who placed his bets not just with bookies on football or basketball, and it was sort of a mess to put an official term on it. It was a mess, Vic. You know, money was flying around like crazy. At times, Pete was betting on sports, different sports games. You know, $30,000 in a day. You know, anyone who knows anything about gambling knows that you don't look at the docket of the day's games and place bets on 10 or 12 different games. That's a hard way to win. You know, you identify two or three, you know, bargains, so to speak, two to three good bets. You place those if you're a sharp or a smart bettor. That's not what Pete Rose was doing. He was placing lots of bets. And, you know, the money got out of control. You know, at times, based on my reporting, you know, Pete was in arrears to multiple bookies across the country. And, you know, in one of these moments in the spring of 1987, with bookies essentially banging down Pete's door asking for their money, one of Pete's inner circle pals at the time essentially pays off a New York bookie, he says, to the tune of roughly $40,000. And he expects that, you know, he'll be reimbursed essentially by Pete. But there was no real agreement between Pete and about this man about what was really owed or what should have been paid. And, you know, this is one of these moments in the story where there's disagreement. It's still disagreement about who was owed what or who should have paid whom. But the fact of the matter is the money is paid. Pete didn't want it to be paid or didn't think it should have been paid. And now there's a beef between these two men that ultimately will lead to the allegations 2 years later.
Many years ago, I had an interview with the manager of the Big Red Machine, the late Sparky Anderson, and he was very complimentary about Pete. He talked about, he called him Peter Edward Rose, and he talked about that sixth game of the 1975 World Series between the Boston Red Sox and the Cincinnati Reds, and just how happy Pete was, even though they lost that game that some people consider to be the greatest World Series game ever, where Carlton Fisk waves the home run past the pesky pole. Peter loved that game, according to Sparky Anderson. He walked off the field with a big smile on his face, even though they lost, because he just loved being a part of it.
I think it highlights two important things about Pete. The first is the man just loved baseball. And it seems like a sort of a trite thing to say, but it's not. I mean, you know, some guys played the game because it was the thing they were best at and they did it, but they enjoyed other things just as much or even more and frankly couldn't wait to retire. That was not Pete Rose. You know, he wanted to be at the ballpark. He lived to be at the ballpark. He lived to play baseball. And so, yes, even in that game, this game six of the 75 World Series, where the Reds are on the precipice of winning their first World Series in decades, Pete's first World Series, Sparky's first World Series, and then they lose it, they fumble it away. Pete is having a blast. You know, even as the game goes into extra innings, he turns to Carlton Fisk, who's catching, and says, you know, something to the effect of, it's a heck of a game, isn't it? You know, and the Reds had already blown it to go to extra innings. So he loves baseball, but he's also just an eternal optimist, which is something, by the way, that Sparky was not. You know, Sparky was a realist, and he was prone to bouts of darkness. Pete just always thinks that things are going to work out. And you know, of course, in 1975, it does. You know, the Reds, of course, win Game 7. But that optimism, you know, is another quality that at times will will hurt Pete off the field. You know, he off the field, he thinks things are going to work out all the time too, and they don't.
Mm. And it was a very different game back then. Ordinary people could still take part in America's pastime. You could have a lot of rabble out there in Shea Stadium and Wrigley Field and places like this that could pelt someone like Pete Rose with all kinds of stuff if they were upset with him. And I interviewed Pete about 5 years ago, and we talked about that a little bit, and we talked about his motivation and things that motivated him to excel. And if you'll humor me, I'd like to play a really brief excerpt from that conversation. Some great photos, too.
Yeah, there is.
And the memories that you have, the wild things that happened to you, like the time you were in Shea Stadium and they threw that empty Jack Daniels bottle at you, it's all here in the book.
Just missed me. Guy in St. Louis, a guy in Chicago threw a crutch at me.
A crutch?
Yeah, from left field, the bleachers. Another guy shot me with a paper clip at me in the neck and blood for 3 innings in right field. Wrigley Field.
Yeah.
That's all part of being hated as a visiting player.
Wow.
But if I'd have played for Chicago, they'd have loved me. And I knew that, and that's the way I played. You know, people are stupid because they don't understand. When I went to Chicago or St. Louis or L.A. or wherever to play and they booed louder than anybody, that motivated me to do well.
Mm-hmm.
It'd have been better off not to say a damn word.
Yeah.
Because I had the attitude, wash us up with a base hit and to go to third on a head first slide and score a run. Gee, that was my philosophy.
The one thing I think that the clip captures and your questions capture is just how raw and unpolished baseball was in the era in which Pete came up. And that's, you know, I think important subtext to his story, you know. And, you know, in the 1960s and 70s, you know, we like to think of baseball as this pure American pastime, but the men playing it were far from pure. You know, they were rough around the edges, you know, and often engaging in all kinds of misdeeds off the field. And making a salary that in most cases wasn't enough to pay their bills. You know, even Pete Rose in the 1960s had winter jobs. You know, he worked at a car dealership on the west side of Cincinnati. So it's a raw sport. It's an unpolished sport. And in the time that Pete's in baseball, you know, between 1963 and 1989, that is one thing that changes. And, you know, baseball becomes more of a corporate sport. And just weeks before the allegations and rumors about Pete's gambling on baseball reaches the front office of Major League Baseball on Park Avenue, Peter Ueberroth, then the commissioner of baseball, had just inked the first $1 billion television contract. So the world has completely changed. Baseball has completely changed. But Pete is sort of unaware of it and is just acting the same way he did 15, 20 years earlier.
The book is Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball, written by Keith O'Brien, who joins us on the program today. I understand he's still given odds on betting. He still doesn't have like a podcast about betting. Do you think he's still gambling heavily?
I haven't had close intimate access to Pete Rose since late 2021, so I can't say what he's doing now. What I can tell you is that, you know, in late 2021, he was still betting on sports. Of course, you know, it's legal now. That's another massive sea change that's happened. You know, last year in America, we wagered $120 billion on sports legally. We probably wagered another $60 billion illegally on sports. Mm. So, you know, nearly $200 billion being wagered on sports, most of it legally. today. And just, you know, for perspective, you know, if we had pooled our money, Vic, instead of betting all of it, you know, we could have bought every single Major League Baseball team and still had tens of billions of dollars jangling around in our pockets. Mm. It's an enormous sum of money that we're now spending to wager on games.
But despite all this legalized gambling, if the manager of the Cincinnati Reds was betting on his own team, that would still be wrong.
Absolutely. And certainly the changes, while cosmically ironic in some ways, do not erase that error. And, you know, Bart Giamatti, the commissioner of baseball in 1989, when Pete got in trouble, you know, said it himself at that time. You know, even a player or a manager, you know, placing bets on their own team to win, which is what the evidence shows Pete did, you know, place bets on the Reds to win, even that is enough to compromise the game, you know, for two reasons. One, Giamatti said, you know, when a player has placed a wager on the game, he could then place personal interests over the interests of the team. That's number one. And two, and perhaps more problematic, you know, a player, especially in the 1980s, who is placing bets, can ultimately affect the game, especially if he were to get in arrears to bookies.
Mm.
A bookie with a player or manager who was in arrears to him, you know, could call in a request to make something happen in a game in order to line his own pockets and maybe erase a debt. So bottom line, as Giamatti said in 1989, gambling is corrosive and it's problematic to the game. And those are phrases that you can scarcely imagine any commissioner or director of a major sports league saying today. You know, every major sports league from baseball to the NFL to the NBA and beyond are all in on the new gambling landscape.
Mm. Well, I'm not a gambler. I've never even bought a lottery ticket. But if I had to place a bet, Keith, I would bet that if Pete reads it, if he reads your book, he's not going to like it.
Well, you know, I don't write books to please anyone. You know, my only goal in writing any work of nonfiction is to get to the closest to the truth. And that was, you know, what I tried to do here without fear or favor, and that is hopefully what I have done here.
Well, I think it's a fantastic biography. I loved it. I think it's brilliant, and I congratulate you.
Thanks so much, Vic. I really appreciate it.
My guest has been Keith O'Brien. His new book, just coming out, is Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. You heard about it on the Book Nook. Keith, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Vic. It was my pleasure.
For the Book Nook, thanks for tuning in.